a quorum right now. We won't take any action on bills until we get it, and we're getting there. We need two more. But we'll take testimony on House File 3133, and we don't need a motion yet because we don't have quorum. Representative Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Chuck Hamilton for the director here. This is a housekeeping bill. I'll represent it if I need to when we start, but I've asked him to come and explain the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Hamilton. I'm one of the directors of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. This is the deed housekeeping bill for this session. It's primarily technical changes. This bill has already been in the Governmental Operations Committee where they were focusing on sections 1 and 6 of the bill. Be happy to go back over those for the committee if that's a desire of the chair. Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 are probably more apropos today. Section 2 has to do with the Small Business Access to Federal Research Funds part of the department. You may recall that there was rider language last session which appropriated $100,000 each year to the department to help small businesses access federal funds through certain sources. Basically, what we're doing here is codifying the rider language from last year. The intent of Representative Gunther at the House as well as the Senate was to appropriate the money, require the department to charge fees, and then have those fees kept within the department to grow the program as opposed to going to the general fund. The Department of Finance has indicated, however, that that last part of the direction to keep it within the department was not made in statute and needs to be put in statute. For that reason, as well as some others, this bill does need to go on to Senator Representative Gunther's committee for further action. So basically, we are putting in statute what you already passed last session. In addition, we're adding a section that the department maintains the proceeds, estimated to be about $20,000. Those are charges to small businesses for classes. Sections 3, 4, and 5 have to do with the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board. Several years ago, a provision was added that would cap, if you will, at 25% the amount of funds an applicant may get for that program for pre-employment expenses. Prior to that, the law was silent, although it certainly was something the board could do. Since the time this was added, the board has found that, in fact, this has prevented them from actually doing some very good awards and has requested that that language be changed. Now, there is an amendment before the committee that we certainly would like to have you work with today. It's the A-1133 amendment, which further clarifies what we're removing. We were going to be removing that cap on advice of House Counsel. The suggestion was made to clarify that it is allowable and that a portion of the funds may be used, but not to tie the hands of the Minnesota Job Partnership Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board. So that's what the amendment will do. Those are really the elements of Section 2 as well as 3, 4, and 5. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if there's other questions regarding Sections 1 and 3, regarding unclassifieds, I'd have to address those also.
Okay, now we do have quorum, so I will officially call the meeting to order. Representative Gazelka moves that House File 3133 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Job Finance Committee.
Can I move that amendment to get the bill in the shape that I needed?
He moves the amendment A061183. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Gazelka, do you have anything further to add?
I don't think so. This is more of a technical bill. Mr. Hamilton mentioned, we've already been through GovOps, and it's going to move to jobs and economic opportunity. You know, so he's pretty much answered or stated what the bill is about.
Okay, Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I just have one question, and pardon me if I've missed something late here, but I was just wondering on where it was requiring the department to implement fees for services that help companies for small businesses seeking innovative grants. I was just wondering, you know, what's the typical description of those companies? Who are these small businesses that are applying that we're asking, thinking to put additional fees on? Do you have kind of a basic category or description?
I can do that. And for more specific questions, we do have additional staff that can answer real technical questions. But basically, the primary customers are small business seeking to utilize the federal government funding high-risk research. Betsy, if you need more specificity than that, we'd be happy to provide it.
Representative Taylor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I just was wondering, are these typically just the really small mom-and-pop businesses, or do they tend to be, a manufacturing? What type of business are they? I was just concerned about fees on very small businesses.
I'm told that these are for businesses under 500 employees.
Do we have someone else coming, or was that it? Sorry. Representative Taylor, did you... want further clarification on that, or does that answer your question?
Oh, I guess that answers it fairly well. I just wondered, the profile of what types of companies they were, in addition to the number. I thank you for clarifying the number of employees.
Representative Wafa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gazelka, and I'll just be brief, but we hid this bill in government operations, and I raised my concern there. In general, I feel like we're creating too many unclassified positions, and I think that makes it difficult for us to recruit up and down the scale in terms of people who are willing to invest our career. But we were told that two of these positions, division directors within the Department of Tourism, are currently vacant, and so they're now in the process of trying to recruit someone. And I said, this is sort of my model example of why sometimes it's not good to have people who are heads of key divisions unclassified, simply because it's hard to recruit the best and the brightest when they only are going to have job security until December 31st. And so I think tourism is such an important part of our economy that we really ought to keep the professionalism in the selection of the people who head up those key programs. And I just wanted to make that statement for those of you who are more informed of what exactly Explore Minnesota is doing and how those positions are being used. But I do think, given the fact that this will be two major positions with a very short horizon, I worry about whether or not we're going to get the kind of expertise to move here, perhaps from other successful programs in other states.
Okay, Representative Lieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question. You had mentioned about the $20,000 in fees would be gathered annually, I assume, under this program. And I'm looking at the language here that required those fees to be implemented. And I'm just wondering, you also mentioned that this would be, obviously what this bill does is bring these back to the department to be used, you said, to grow the program. If they're going to grow the program, I'm wondering, how are these fees determined? Are they, let me just leave it at that. How are you determining what the fees should be?
Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebland, good question. As part of last year's rider language, the department was also required to report to the chairs of the funding committees by February 1st. That did occur. In a letter from Mr. Mark Loftus, the director of the Office of Business Development, to Representative Gunther as well as the Senate, basically took a look at what it would cost to put these training programs together based on some other information. That fee is estimated to be about $75 per business in order to do that. This will not start until after July 1st of 2006, so we don't see anything coming in the 2005 year, but it is an annual figure that we're anticipating. And it's just based on the cost. There's not intended profit or otherwise in there.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I came in late, but I'm wondering what problem are we trying to solve on page 3 where originally I see you deleted the up to 25% can be used for pre-employment training, and the amendment now says a portion of what is the concern there that's being addressed?
Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark. Again, the sections 3, 4, and 5, we're doing the same thing to all of them because that phrase is in all three. Several years ago, someone brought forward the idea of putting that language in order to stimulate the board to maybe consider more pre-employment training as part of the grants that they're giving out. The law was silent on that prior to that. in the process of working with that language this past year, the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board found that, in fact, they could not award some grants or were, had difficulty in their standard way because some of the good grants were over the 25%. So the board has requested that that be removed so it doesn't tie their hands. House staff have suggested to us to be a bit more forward-thinking so we don't have to come back, and we thought it was a very good idea to put in the amendment that a portion of the funds may so that the board's hands aren't tied, and that's why we're doing it.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, Representative Gazelka renews this motion. The House File 3133, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Jobs Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Gazelka, your next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, let's see, let me get it in front of me now. House File 2878, I would like to move that we pass that and refer that to Health Policy and Finance.
Yep. Representative Gazelka moves House File 2878 be recommended pass and be referred to Health Policy and Finance.
If Representative I may, I have one oral amendment, if I may, to get that in a little bit better shape. On page 2, line 17, I would like to strike the words "the primary beneficiary" and add the word "a." Visiting with Tom Pender, we felt like it made more sense. A primary beneficiary is a term that could make it more confusing if we don't just leave it as the word "a beneficiary."
Okay, Representative Gazelka moves that on page 2, line 17. The words "the primary beneficiary" be stricken.
I'm sorry. The primary.
The
not
primary.
Not beneficiary, but
oh, okay. I apologize. The words "the primary" be stricken and replaced with the word "a."
Yes.
Mr. Pender, is that? Did you have something to add to that?
No, Mr. Chair. That's the correct one.
Okay. Everybody have that? All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Gazelka.
Thank you. I purposely wanted to see this bill heard second because it's a little bit complicated, but I think it could solve something very good for people, whether they're on the Iron Range or Southwest Minnesota or all kinds of different places. This came from basically out of my insurance practice. If an older person, probably one or two times a year, an older person would come into my office, somebody over, say, age 65, 70, 75, and they'll have a policy, a life insurance policy that is $10,000, $20,000, $25,000, and that policy has cash value. It built up some cash value in there, and they come in to me telling me that they've got to take all the money out of that policy so that they're going to be eligible for medical assistance. And so, in effect, what they've had to do is cash out these policies that they've had for 20, 25, 30, 35 years to get medical assistance. And it's been recommended to them by the people that are going to give them medical assistance. And so what they typically do with that money is they spend it. They spend it on whatever. So it doesn't go to the government. And it doesn't go to their beneficiaries. And I thought, this is crazy. Why are we doing this? Is there a better way to do this? And so I've begun the process. I don't know that we're definitely not going to solve it here. Just this morning, I found some roadblocks that I have to overcome. But what this bill, I'll review it, but in a nutshell, what this bill is proposing is that rather than do that, they can agree to enter into an agreement with the state that says at their death, the state would get up to half of the life insurance benefit, and their beneficiaries would get the other half. So what I'm desiring to do is to create a win-win for the state and for that person's beneficiaries. And so I have just an example. This isn't, frankly, a perfect example, but it's an example of a life insurance policy that I thought I'd review, if you can pass that around. Just to while that's coming around, I'll explain it. But the reason why I say there's some roadblocks is I just got a fiscal note this morning, and they're saying it's, in fact, the number they came out with was $20 million to do this, and I'm thinking, you know, they took an average of $20,000 of cash per policy times 4,100, when all of the clients that I see that need this have less than $20,000 of cash in them. And it's typically somebody that has nothing, so they usually only had a small life insurance policy. And so I don't know how they got their number, but I, to be honest, have not had time to talk to the gentleman that came up with that number. And so I have to work on that, and I'm hoping you'll consider passing this and moving it on so that I can deal with it in another committee. So while that's going around, I'll just do the quick overview. Section 1, it says the life insurance gives the Commissioner of Human Services the option to allow medical assistant applicants to retain life insurance policies if the applicant enters into an agreement to share the policy proceeds with the state if medical assistance services are provided for which a recovery could be made. Option to retain the policies says the states that the commissioner may allow that applicant against whom there could be an actual or potential claim for recovery of medical assistance provided the option of retaining permanent life insurance policies and excluding these policy assets. So the idea is these assets then would not count for medical assistance. They would take this as a separate contract. It provides that the cash surrender value of the life insurance policies retained is not an asset for purpose of calculating the community's spouse asset allowance. And then it describes some definitions. I can go into those more if I need to. Looking on page 2 of the overview, the top there describes what they have to enter into to have one of these. And frankly, you know, everything that we're asking them to do in all the policies, at least that I deal with, this every one of them would qualify. Every one of them could do this. There are going to be some policies that wouldn't be eligible, but I'm certain the majority would. B states that the agreement with the commissioner is irrevocable and remains in effect through the remainder of the applicant's life, regardless of whether the applicant remains eligible for medical assistance. Because if they entered into this, you know, I don't want to penalize the state. You know, I'm trying to find something that's a win-win for both sides. C requires the agreement to allow the applicant to designate or change beneficiaries with respect to the portion of the death benefit not payable to the commissioner. So again, what I'm proposing is that we add the state as a beneficiary. That means, you know, that they would get up to half of the death benefits, but the other half is the beneficiaries of that, the person, the insured, and so they should be able to change that whenever they want to. Subsection 4 describes the procedure and how we're going to do it. Subsection 5 is how we're going to share the benefit, the death benefits. And what we did there is the state gets up to half, but if they didn't use all the medical assistance, then the person's original beneficiaries get that extra money. So they get no less than half, and in many cases they may get more than half. So that's, I think, a quick overview. Now, everybody got the life policy. I know this is, I've listed some numbers on this. So I want to kind of give you an idea of one and how it would work. If you look at the number 2 on there, I circled the number 2. This is an example of a $25,000 policy. And if that person died, they would get $25,000, number 2, plus the number just below the number 3 I circled. So $25,000 plus $6,970. So the death benefit would be about $31,000. So in this case, if they entered in with the state, that number, $31,000, would be split between the state and the original beneficiaries. So each of them would get about not quite $16,000. When if we don't do that, this what happens is if you look at the number 1, the policy had about $9,000 of cash in it. They'd be spending that down to nothing. The state gets nothing. The beneficiaries get nothing. So I'm trying to find a way to make this work for both sides. A number 4 there just kind of gives you what happens in a policy that pays annual dividends. The longer most people have a life insurance policy, the greater that number becomes, in such a way that if you've had one 30 years or longer, that typically is more than enough to just keep paying the premium. So So I know it's technical, as, you know, and I don't expect everybody to understand the detail part of it, but the concept is what I'm trying to get you to buy into, and then if we can find a way to work with DHS to make this work with them, then I'm all for it. I did visit with the insurance industry, and they are at least neutral to this. They think it's a good idea if we can make it work, and if we're not putting more undue pressure on them to try to get this done. So I've talked to the Commerce Department. They again are neutral. They don't have a problem with it. So with that, I'll entertain any questions.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I read through the bill, I didn't see any reference to any accumulated dividends. Did I see this?
That would be considered part of the cash value.
I thought cash value and dividends were two distinct different things.
I guess it depends on how we define it. If you look on the number one I gave in that life insurance example, that's total cash value. That includes all the cash of the dividends. I think typically they're going to be included in that number.
Okay.
But that's, I think, you know, part of the reason, again, I wanted everybody to be here for this is if there's things that I need to improve, I absolutely want to. And if that's, I'd have to talk to DHS and how they handle medical assistance for that question.
Representative Paul.
Okay, and we can come back to that if this moves on. If the owner doesn't agree to sign over the rights, then does Section 1, Subdivision 1 apply?
Representative Pizzolfa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paul, this is May. In other words, if they don't sign this agreement, then present law takes place where these are considered part of their assets.
Okay. And then one more clarifying question, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Under Subdivision 5, can you explain the under C, line 331, C are not subject to estate recovery? I didn't understand that.
Representative Zilka.
We're talking line, which line are we on?
331, item C.
I'll get there in a second.
Okay.
If they enter into this agreement, that section 256B.15 is claims against the states, I believe, related to medical assistance. So this is not included in how they recover money back from the beneficiaries of that person.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
That does make sense. Thank you.
Andrew, do you have something to add?
Mr. Chair and Representative Paul, what that sentence is meant to deal with is a situation where, notice that sentence starts, if a beneficiary is the applicant's estate. So if the applicant lists his beneficiary under this policy as his estate, then this keeps the state from going after that money as it would otherwise go after if he, you know, ended up with a lot of money in his estate after having gotten medical assistance.
Right, but the agreement would still be in effect.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Hey, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gazelka, I don't see a limitation. You talked about, you know, most of these policies that I see are only $20,000. My question or concern would be if, let's say that I've got a $2 million policy and I've got $1 million parked in there, is that, are we looking to protect those people from paying their share today of their MA, or not of MA, but of their medical bills before it would fall upon the taxpayer? I also think that may impact your fiscal note if you can cap it so that the folks that it would apply to, there's probably driving the average up. If the fiscal people are assuming that, you know, this becomes now a an opportunity to park money and protect yourself. It's an estate planning tool and so forth.
Yep.
That might be why the fiscal notice is significant.
Yep. Representative Gazelka?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I agree, and I think that we probably have to have a limitation on here. In my experience, the people that have the bigger policies never need medical assistance. Yeah. But I think you're exactly right that that's where this is going. And so I am definitely open to exploring limitations. Its purpose is not for people to protect assets, but rather to have life insurance for final expenses that they had for 30 years and then had to cash out. You know, what I'm really trying to address is the people that are generally going on medical assistance because they need it, and not causing them to waste the policy that they pay for forever on.
Just an observation.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gazelka. I like the idea. I support the concept. I think it makes a great deal of sense, and it's penny wise and pound foolish to cause people to cash in. I don't necessarily like universal life or whole life policies to begin with, but to cash them in at this stage is silly. But the cap, I think, would be necessary, and I think you'd be more likely to draw support for it if you were to propose that as part of the bill.
In fact, if you want to help me on that, I'm you're the man.
And after civil law, we'll go.
Have fun there. Representative Clark.
I have a couple questions. The first one is, you said you're trying to prevent these older folks from wasting the money. What do you mean by waste? What would be an example of the wasteful use of these 70, 80, 90-year-olds wasting their money on that you're so concerned about?
Representative Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I know I need to be careful there. I mean, it's spending the money away on anything just to get down to the limits. And I don't want to pick any one thing that they could spend their money on, but, you know, it's kind of up to them. And so where they would have kept that money in there for the goal that they purchased it for, to take care of final expenses, to pass on to their beneficiaries, this is forcing them to give that up. And so anytime anybody has an immediate amount of cash, they sometimes don't use it as like they would have if they didn't have it. And what I mean by that is, for many years, they haven't looked at that as money in the policy for them to spend. It's been a policy to pass on to the next generation, take care of final expenses and anything left over. Versus if you suddenly have a bunch of cash, whether it's a lottery or whatever, you don't necessarily spend it the way you normally would. And so, you know, it can be whatever they want it to spend it down. So I'd rather not, you know, judge what somebody wants to spend money on, other than to say I don't think they would have done that if they could have found another solution to keep the policy.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Clark. It just seems like micromanaging to the nth degree. I mean, I can think of, let me tell you something. My dad's 90 years old, and in 2 weeks he's going on a cruise.
That's
and,
why,
you know,
yeah.
I am so pleased. If whatever he has, I just think, go for it. He's going with family.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we want him to be able to do that? He's a guy who, well, he only lives on a little bit of Social Security. He's definitely one of the people you'd be impacting here. Why wouldn't we want to let him use that for whatever he wants to do, including maybe having a grandson go to college? Why would you want to micromanage how he could spend that?
Representative Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I think you misunderstand the bill, because this is only an option. This is if they want to go this route. If they want to cash out the policy and do the cruise, if that is eligible with medical assistance guidelines, they can do it. But this adds another option where they can say, you know what, I really wanted that life policy to remain, and then split the benefit with the state. They basically have half of something they wouldn't have had. But they don't have to do this. This is something they can choose to do but don't have to do. If they choose to do it, then they have to present the policies that they want to do it on to, I think it's the state. But they have to, you know, and so if they could even withhold the policy, then they're going to have to cash it out.
So, Representative Gazelka, it prevents the forced spend down from the state.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, that's exactly what this is doing. It's giving them one other way to do it. And if somebody wants to spend the money for something, I agree with you. I'm all in favor of that, Representative Clark. But if they didn't want to do it and they're forced to do it, that's a different story.
Okay. If that, is it...
Well, Mr. and I guess I just heard you describe it as, you know, the wasteful things that these, you know, people waste their money, they don't know what to do with their money because they happen to be old, and I guess I just take some objection to that.
Yeah, I don't think he meant it to be, say it's, you know, just frivolous and that they should be, you know, squirreling it away and not enjoying their assets, but the way that MA works, it does kind of force you to spend down when you might not want to. I have Representative Soderstrom, Liebling, Loeffler, and Mullery. Representative Soderstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. When I'm looking at this, the amount of the policy is $25,000, and let's say that that you decided to cash it in and spend it however you wanted, you would get $9,573. So wouldn't the insurance company maybe rather that they would take their money, because if I died a month later, they'd have to pay out $25,000. Is that correct?
Representative Gazelle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Soderstrom, you are absolutely right. You're a genius. I will tell you that, you know, the insurance companies are not opposed to this because they believe it's the right thing for the insured. But they are better off, Representative Rukavina, if they were to have to cash this policy out.
Okay, and then I just have a comment. It's sort of related to this. I helped an older lady. It was a neighbor that was on SSI, Social Security and SSI, and she only got like $300 a month because she had never worked and so forth. But one day she was taken off of SSI because they kept monitoring her bank account, and she had too much money. So for like 3 months, she didn't get that extra $300 and had to live on the Social Security. But anyway, what I had to do is start watching her checking account. We had to spend that money foolishly, kind of. I told her, I said, well, let's get a new TV set for you, and you need a new coat. So, I mean, we bought several things that we wouldn't have bought otherwise to spend down so she qualified. Yeah. So, and I don't know, maybe that wasn't foolish, but in order to qualify, we had to spend that money.
Representative Soderstrom, that is basically the type of thing I'm trying to get at for this, that they don't have to do that. They want to do that, fine, but if I can make this work, they don't have to take that option.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gazelka. I guess I don't know enough about the way medical assistance works entirely. First question is there some kind of exclusion for final expenses? I mean, if you didn't do this, would you be able to set aside some of your assets for final expenses under medical assistance?
Representative Gazelka. Mr. Chair, Representative Leland, I don't think I'm qualified to give you an exact answer on that.
Leibling, I think there might be Mr. Pender or DHS. How about DHS? Put that one up. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Mazin. I'm with the Department of Human Services, the healthcare area, and I work in medical assistance eligibility. Mr. Chair, Representative Leibling, in answer to your question, there is an independent burial exclusion that people can have on medical assistance of $1,500. And there is some interplay with life insurance, so if you designate certain of your policies as your burial exclusion, they wouldn't be eligible for this exclusion that this bill would entail. So I hope that, does that answer your question?
Representative Leibling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it actually confuses me a little bit more because what I'm kind of getting at here is that, Representative Gazelka, you have kind of indicated that the interest that you're getting at here, there are kind of two interests, if I'm understanding you, that you want these people to be able to both have some assets that can pay for final expenses and be able to pass something down to their heirs. And I'm just wondering if the final expense piece, is that something that's really needed, or is that already kind of taken care of in other ways?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I'm actually, you know, the final expense is typically one of the reasons that it's used for, but I'm really thinking broader in letting them keep half of a life insurance policy that they've spent, you know, years accumulating, and then letting the state take the other half. So my perception is that it's a win-win.
Mr.
Chair. Representative Leland.
Thank you. Well, okay, given that, see, that makes me really have a little concern about this bill, because I don't know why you would treat, then you're, it seems to me that what you're doing here is kind of preferring people's assets that are in a certain form. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody likes to have to, you know, this spend down thing, you know, applies to a lot of people who have a lot of different kinds of assets, and nobody likes to have to, you know, nobody likes to have to do this. This is painful for a lot of people, and it seems to me that what we're doing here is preferring a certain kind of asset. I mean, let's face it, you know, nobody likes to pay these kinds of expenses at the end of life. Certainly, you know, even people who are paying for it themselves, you know, it's not something anybody wants to do. But it just gives me concern why we would, I can understand wanting to shelter a little bit for final expenses and so on, but it seems to me that in order to have something to hand down to your heirs, gee, that's something everybody would like to do, even if they, in whatever form their assets are in, and I frankly don't really see why we would want to just prefer this kind of asset.
Representative Zelda.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, if it can't at least be neutral for the state, then I'm not supporting it. What if you looked at this one example I showed, $31,000 approximately of life insurance, and the state gets half, approximately $16,000. That's $16,000 that the state would not have got, because they would have spent it down, as Representative Soderstrom used in a different example. They would have just spent it on whatever. And so what I'm trying to find is a win-win for both the state and the person that has the need. It's, to me, it's not really about sheltering it. It's about trying to find a way to benefit both that person and the state differently than what we're doing right now. And what we're doing right now is they're cashing out the policies, the state gets nothing, and in the end, it's conceivable that the state's going to pay for most of their funeral and all of those things. And so this is an attempt to find a solution that really rewards both sides.
Representative Liebling.
Just one brief follow-up to that. Representative Gazelka, I understand what you're saying, but do you have any data on how many of these policies there are, how many get cashed out, and so on? Because it seems to me that what we're doing here is trying to find a solution for some people who are kind of avoiding the rules by cashing out and spending down. And I know it's kind of human nature to do that, but, you know, it's kind of not, it seems to me that that's not really what people are supposed to be doing. And I'm wondering, is this just a really broad problem where tons of people are doing this, so the state is missing a huge amount of assets, or is it something that only those who are kind of in the know end up doing?
Representative Gazelka.
I'm writing that question down, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling. I can tell you that I have about 900 life insurance policies, and we deal with this a couple times every year. And it's not me helping them plan. It's them coming to me saying, I've got to cash this out. You know, so that's what triggered this. This hasn't been done in any other state, apparently. But it's something that I think we can find as a way to help both sides of this. But I'm that is one thing I have to get is more data.
And Mr. Chair, where is this going?
This is going to Health Policy and Finance. So it's got another stop.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gazelka. This is an area that brings up all kinds of ethics and who thinks who should pay and how. I can say I think the bottom line is the insurance companies win, because in the example, as Representative Soderstrom pointed out, the $25,000 that would have been paid otherwise potentially, you know, turns into, you know, $10,000. It gets split different ways. But I think apart from that, I think there's three issues you should look at thinking about considering as you pursue this. One is the length of ownership. Your example is people who have been paying into this insurance policy for years and years. I don't think your intent is to create a new dodge in which people of wealth or some means run to their insurance agencies and buy a life insurance policy in order to, you know, shelter dollars and get half of it back. I don't think that was your intent, but I think you might want to look at the length of time that someone has committed into this, so it isn't creating a new shelter. The other thing that I'd like you to do is add on an appropriation line, and that's for the county expenses, because you have in your bill a fair amount of responsibility for counties to now be more involved in estate advising of seniors. They're supposed to collect all this information on insurance policies, and then they're supposed to, you know, send notices out to the insurance policy and negotiate an agreement and explain it to seniors who may at that time be at a point of Alzheimer's or other disabilities in which it's difficult for the senior to understand what's going on, and yet they have to make an informed choice. And so it seems to me that there's a lot of responsibility here being put on to the counties, particularly when you've had in the insurance business, as in every other business, a lot of mergers. I mean, people have insurance policies in the drawer that they bought back in 1947, and you find out that company doesn't exist, and you got to track back, you know, who is the holder of that policy now, and maybe you're in the industry that maybe it's easier than it sounds like some of my relatives have had to deal with, but I do think that you ought to respect the fact that the counties are going to be taking on some new roles here, and they ought to get some compensation for the additional cost.
We, Representative Loeffler, we do deal with that in the health policy and finance, so that'd be, we'd bring up the bill for that. But Representative Gazelle.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I can just address the first two insurance companies, they, if we do this, this is not a benefit to them compared to where they are today. Because what happens today under this scenario is they'd pay out $9,000 versus if we adopt this, they pay out $31,000. So this is definitely not a benefit to insurance companies. And then as far as the length of ownership, that's either, you know, it's right to be thinking about that. As I think through it, and I need to think through it more, it's typically, unless you've had a policy for a long time, this isn't going to work because the dividends increase over time. They get larger and larger over time. And so for a 75-year-old to suddenly say, I'm going to take out this big policy to protect assets, I think would be difficult, but I will think through that.
Well, Representative Gazelka, to that point, if I can, if I was in that situation and I had $50,000 in my bank account, could I park that in some kind of whole life policy with a lump sum payment and therefore shelter half of it from the state?
Well, right now you couldn't shelter it from the state. If we do this, the part I need to think through is if they took $50,000, they'd probably get about a maybe a $90,000 policy. You know, and if they agreed to set this up with the state, that means they'd get $45,000 and their beneficiaries would. So there's, I can't see why a person would want to do this because they're going to have to split the life insurance benefit with the state anyway. You know, I'm just saying, if you're an older person, you're buying life insurance, you don't get a lot of bang for the buck as you get older.
But if I had that $50,000 in my bank account, it'd be gone because they'd have to spend it down. But I could put it into a $90,000 whole life policy or whatever kind of life. I don't do life at all. So, and I could shelter that. And actually, you know, I put it in and it would be a $50,000 cash value. And I could get pretty much all that back.
Yeah.
Is that right?
The way you're describing it, yes. You know, and I think, you know, that is something I need to walk through to figure out. I'm not trying to create a shelter. But even in that scenario, the state would get half at death of $45,000, and the beneficiaries would get half of $45,000. So that person, you know, they'd have to really think through if that's what they're going to do. But I do need to think through the larger estate issues.
Right. Sorry, Representative Loeffler, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gazelka. I think actually there are circumstances in which the family is actually in a better situation, which they chose not to take advantage of this. And I'm just going to use the example you threw out. Because most people, when they're applying for medical assistance, it's at a time of a medical or health crisis, and oftentimes it's a terminal diagnosis. And you really have to kind of bet on how long is mom or dad going to live to figure it out. Because in your example, the person who's got the $25,000 policy with $9,000 cash value. If they were, you know, so they would be able to retain $4,500 here. under your proposal, because they'd be able to save half the cash value, as I understand it. But maybe I'm an act. But the concept is if the policy stayed and they paid out of the family's assets, perhaps they have other assets, they paid the nursing home for 2 months, and mom dies. Okay, that's $6,000 or $7,000 in nursing home expense. And then they can the family can cash in on the $25,000. And so to some families, it actually may be to their advantage to pay out the cost depending upon the expected life expectancy. And that's an example of the type of kind of difficult situations that you're going to have counties trying to explain to seniors and their heirs, because it isn't as quick and easy as you get the money and you get to use it. It's really a much more strategic decision, and it's a much more difficult one, because you really have to guess how long is someone going to stay in the nursing home or in the hospital or whatever, and then balance it out.
Representative Loeffler, one thing, you know, in this, if they enter into this agreement, the cash value is locked up. It's no longer half available to them. They can't get at it. They've entered into agreement where basically the state gets half of the life insurance proceeds, and their beneficiaries get the other half. And so, in effect, it's like the state agreeing that it's worth it to them to not receive that cash now, to get half of the life insurance benefit at their death. Just like people buy life insurance now, they have to weigh out, is this worth it? Is it worth the money? We're taking that a little bit farther and saying the state, you know, would enter in and get half of that in lieu of taking the cash.
Mm-hmm. Representative Zuck, I think you might be able to fix it just by preventing lump sum purchases. It might not even be a time frame. I got Representative Mullery, Vanderveer, Hamilton, and Rukavina. Representative Mullery.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gazalka, I don't necessarily, as I discussed this bill with you, there's some considerable pros, and I've tried to work sometimes the things with DHS in the past that seemed logical but haven't gotten very far. I think, how do we and there is a distinction, but part of the point of this is that the state can get more by actually being reasonable with the spend down, and why are we not looking, and I agree, I understand that you've just got a narrow bill, but should we not be looking at that whole issue of... we're forcing people into spend downs. It's a waste to everybody. Is there a way that we should achieve the same kind of look at achieving something that's beneficial to both sides? And I don't think you're going to have a great answer today, but I think as you proceed, there's that issue along with this. Because there is, somebody raised the why are we distinguishing one from another. While there's this distinction here, what we're getting at as a soft final issue has to do with other assets too. So I think that's going to come up.
Yeah. Representative Walker. Well said. Mr. Chair, but Representative Mullery, we need to keep working on things that make sense. You know, this to me is definitely it's not DFL or Republican. It's something that we can benefit the state and the consumer, and I think everybody in this room wants to do that if we can find a way to do it.
One of the distinctions between this and other assets is this has a higher value than just the cash value. So it's not like...
I said there is a distinction.
Okay. Representative Vanderbilt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It just seems pretty straightforward, though, that this is a benefit, right? Because right now they can just take the money, the cash value out of the policy, and that, is that correct?
Representative,
that's
correct.
So that's cashed in, and then it's all over. One thing you could do, too, is require, couldn't you, that the policy had been held for a certain period of time? Would that?
Those are all
representative. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vanderveer, that may or may not be beneficial. Some, you know, the longer the policy, to a point, yes. I mean, you know, maybe 10 years or longer, that could answer that. But some policies aren't beneficial to do this until they're 20 years old, some 30 years old. But you know.
I mean, to deal, Mr. Chair and Representative Gazalka, to deal with the issue brought up by the chair.
Yeah.
But at any rate, I think I understand it. Thank you.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think, you know, that Representative Gazalka is trying to do something good here, and it's nice to see Representative Gazalka carrying a bill that actually doesn't benefit an insurance company. So, you know, I'm watching this stuff happen firsthand to my mother, and I saw it happen to my aunt. I'm my aunt's guardian. I'm watching my mother in a nursing home. You know, a lot of families, the only thing they have to give their kids are their house, which now we've managed, I think, to take away around here. Although we didn't go back retroactively, we fixed that last year. And a small insurance policy that people got because they don't want to saddle their kids in case they died unexpectedly or whatever with any debts or funeral expenses they had. And I think Representative Gazalka has got a unique approach to this. I really, you know, because like I said, I've seen it happen on a daily basis. I've seen spend downs. I watched my mom pay the extra $2,000 a year that goes into the general fund to pay for Edina's and Egan's and Eden Prairie's property, you know, education levy takeover. And I heard the governor say he didn't raise taxes the other day, and I'm trying to tell my mother, Ma, he said he didn't raise taxes, so just trust him. But anyhow, back to this bill. you know, what you're trying to do is good. And I think, you know, people are making a lot of hoopla about nothing. I think Representative Loeffler brought up a legitimate point about the length of time you've had it, and certainly Representative Atkins has brought up a legitimate point about limiting it to a certain dollar amount. And I think, you know, Joe's insured for $10 million, by the way, I heard. anyway, and well worth every penny. But anyway, I think what you're doing is good. I think you've got a couple of suggestions of putting it up. And having seen, you know, people that worked hard all their lives and didn't save as much as they could save, watching it go away daily, it's I think this is a good idea to try to keep some of that asset for these people. So, you know, people with a lot of money, they don't have to worry about this stuff. You know, they can hire attorneys that can figure out how to hide their money, or they can hire nurses to take care of their parents and grandchildren. You're going after the common, trying to help the common, ordinary person, and I commend you for it, and I think we're kind of worrying about some things. There are some legitimate concerns, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Gazelle has agreed to work on them before the next hearing.
And it'll be worked on before then, I'm sure, and Representative Gazelka, at this point, I don't have anyone else on the list, so Representative Gazelka renews his motion that House File 2878 be recommended pass and referred to Health Policy and Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, I'd move that House File 12 be recommended to pass, and I don't know, I think we put this on the consent calendar last year, to tell you the truth.
I don't remember. General Register.
Okay. Members, this is back here because it sat on the General Register.
Representative Rukavina moves House File 12 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. You may remember we had a lengthy discussion on this bill last year, and the reason I brought it forward is because one of the workers at a hotel restaurant in my district had tried to have her daughter hired, and her daughter was under 18, and because they serve alcohol, the owner there knew the rules and said she couldn't be hired. Unless there was some kind of appeals process, you could go to the Department of Labor and Industry because of alcohol being served. And this just says that, you know, they could bus tables and not serve the alcohol itself, unless it was in a 3-2 joint, I believe. They could actually, in
in subdivision 2 of the bill. And I think the hospitality industry supports it. It's sometimes very hard to find workers out in rural Minnesota in the hospitality industry, especially, you know, for seasonal employment. I really don't see a problem with members. And in fact, Mr. Chair, last year we had high school groups coming around on different bills, and I had a group from the Egan High School, and they asked me about my bill and why I was doing it, and I told them why, and two of your constituents' children said to me, well, we've been working in an establishment that serves liquor since we were 16. So I think there's a lot of people that don't even know this law exists. So
this bill's got to pass.
So that was the reason I introduced it, and I appreciate your support.
Any questions for members? Seeing none, Representative Rucker Wiener moves this motion that House File 12 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And we are adjourned.